The generalized EDM formula is a means EDM formalism generalized by tetrads and spin. There's a paper in the 70s by Isham and Deser in 76 where they introduced tetrads into the EDM formalism, but they didn't went through a full reduction and a full development of the framework. They applied it for the Dirac equation in curved spacetime. But I will show you how it works for classical particles. Now, at first, a small overview of what has been achieved in the Hamiltonian framework. I focus on Hamiltonian. I do not mention, but only in, in one of my sections, I will compare with effective field theory results. But in general, I will talk about only the Hamiltonian approach. And here, the first was, which I would like to mention, is a three-pin result in 2001. It's the first time that dimensional regularization was applied to post-Newtonian. You know, dimensional regularization is a young discipline invented in the 70s of the last century by Weltmann and in Toft. They got the Nobel Prize for this in showing the renormalizability of Young-Mills field theories. And here is the first application for classical generativity, particularly in the post-Newtonian framework. Damour mentioned it already in 82, the dimensional regularization, but he rejected it in favor of analytic regularization, Hadamard par défini and so on, and he said, it's not clear if it is completely convincing physically. The result we achieved, the three-pin result, with dimensional regularization, was a confirmation of a result obtained the year before. We fit it to Brillinquist initial value problem, we applied Poincaré algebra, we had all coefficients in our Hamiltonian, but not a unique method for deriving it. And we succeeded with dimensional regularization, we were happy. One method, one result, one unique result, and the result confirmed what we knew before already. And though all we were satisfied, also Thibault, seeing how well dimensional regularization works, also he was before a little bit skeptical. Now, in history, just to mention, the 3.5, this is the next leading order radiation damping. We already succeeded in 97. It was easier to calculate in the 3PN because it's a radiation reaction structure. Now, the one post-Minkowskian result was achieved with Ledwinka and Bitschak in 2008. It's also a full expert analytic solution of the problem of the post-Minkowskian n-body interaction, so we can kind of scattering and so on. Barak was mentioning it for light, scattering of light, one can do scattering of light. Now, this paper of Steinhoff and myself in 2009, the linear spin coupling to gravity, this is the main chapter of my talk. I will explain it, the details of this paper to you. Now, the spin orbit coupling, if the spin is counted 1 over c, then the 2.5, the next leading order, was achieved in 2008 by Domoyanovsky and myself. And quite recently, Hartung and Steinhoff succeeded with the next leading order, spin-orbit coupling. And the leading order radiation reaction was only recently obtained for its 4PN level by Steinhoff and Wang. This is also a radiation reaction. It's a damping structure. Now, a first result, the spin 1, spin 2 coupling, also the spin counted at 1 over C. The next leading order, 3PN was achieved, here you see. The next leading order, also quite recently, very recent even, yeah, and the leading order radiation reaction, which is 4.5 PN, was also obtained quite recently. You will also all find these papers on the archive, and you find more details in the archive here. Now the spin squared coupling. This is spin squared, it is a rotation deformation of a spinning body. This was achieved in Hamiltonian approach in 2008 for black holes and for neutron stars only in 2010. But there are some other terms calculated the linear in spin, a higher order in spin coupling. So you see this goes up to the third order in spin. It goes in the momentum, as momentum, third order in spin. This is even fourth order in spin. This I calculated with Herrick earlier. And there is a paper, a Hamiltonian approach to a test spin in Kerr, in the Kerr metric by Alexandra and collaborators, Marus and he's here and Racine. And this is, so to say, linear in the test particle spin, but for nonlinearity in the Kerr metric. So it's a nice result. And this is a limiting case for our calculation. That's what you have seen here is all is with binary calculations, yes, with arbitrary mass ratios. This is a test body approach, and the limiting case, we found full agreement with what they have obtained, yes. So all limiting cases are full under control. So we have full confidence that the calculations we have done are correct. Even so, we have not yet a comparison, for example, here next to next leading order, so 4PN, spin coupling was calculated in my group, but it was also calculated by Michel Levy. We know the results, but the comparison has still to be done. I will show you in one of my sections how complicated it is to compare results from effective field theory approach to the Hamiltonian approach. So I show it from the next leading order and not the next leading order because it's an open problem still. But we are sure we'll succeed and we'll find agreement between the both approaches. Okay, so this is what has been achieved in the Hamiltonian approach. That's all. So what you do not see here has not yet been achieved. That's it. Yeah. We hope to make some further progress in the future. Of course, life is going on and new things have to be calculated. Okay, now the outline of my talk. I will at first give you some insight in spin in Minkowski space. It's an introductory character to show you how nice relations exist for spin in Minkowski space. Then I will give you higher order post-Hamiltonian Hamiltonians. I give a summary of what is known, some explicit expressions. Interesting is, you see, also in curved space-time, the relations of Minkowski space are valid if the curved space-time is asymptotically flat. So it's really very nice. You see, if the world is asymptotically flat, we have arbitrary strong gravity inside. We can apply the global Poincaré group for the global conserved quantities. So this means what we can learn in Minkowski space is still valid with respect to the algebra in global space. If you are not in cosmology. Cosmology is a disaster because then the metric gets dynamical, the whole metric, and you have no bound from below. You see, we know if you have asymptotically flat space-time, energy is bounded from below. Also, you have black holes, energy is bounded from below. But if you have cosmology, you have a disaster because energy is not bounded from below. You can extract a bit of much energy from the cosmological background, and you are out of control, you see. Yeah, this means it's a global instability, which is, so to say, something I think not really understood, but I restrict to asymptotically flat space-times. In this sense, all is under control. Good, okay. Then I will show you spin and gravity in general because I have to introduce tetrads for coupling. Also for classical spin, I have to introduce tetrads, not only for quantum spin, for Dirac field, also for classical spin, I have to introduce tetrads to get a clean coupling of spins to gravity. Yeah? And that's the reason why I have a small section here, spin and gravity in general. Then the Hamiltonian formulation for spinning objects. Then I will make the comparison between results from effective field theory, results obtained by Porter-Rothstein and Levy, and as a next leading order results I will compare. All is consistent, but to show how far away apart the results are, and one has to work hard to see. Now finally, I will show how Dirac delta functions can represent black holes, which is a funny thing because the delta function is a point and a black hole is an extended object. How can an extended object be represented by a delta function? That's the idea behind this. I will show you in detail how it works. And you will see, it's like in electrodynamics, in electrostatics, for example, okay? You have a charged sphere and inside you have an image charge. Image charge is point-like, does not exist in reality. You have only the charge distribution over the sphere. Okay? And you can sort of represent the field outside by virtual source inside the sphere, yeah, which is fictitious, does not exist. In our case here in gravity, the mass is not sitting in real space. The mass is sitting in conformally transformed space. Yeah, the mass sitting in conformally related space generates a field, and this field is a metric field in another space. And the mass, which is formally sitting, then we can, so to say, transform or adjust it also to the real space. The real space is flat where the mass is sitting because it's definitely not there. So it cannot curve the space there. Yeah? So this will explain you later in my last section. It's also something it's nice to understand. Now, Spin-Minkowski space. Now, first of all, Kova, electrically charged spinning particle, an electron, for example, you get here the center of mass equation of motion. Here you get the spin equation of motion. This is a famous Pauli-Lubanski vector, the W for Lubanski vector. If you have G equal to 2, you get this simple result. It's well known, the gyro factor. Yeah. And we have, so to say, some supplementary conditions. So the mass shell condition, the spin condition, Poincaré vector squared is this here, and the orthogonality of spin and for momentum. So this is a very nice relation, manifest covariant, elegant, but there is much inside you cannot see. This you see if you do a canonical approach. Yeah? That's the reason why I present it here. Now if we go to a canonical formulation, what we have to introduce, as we introduce, for example, as the momentum, the position of the particle, the spin, it's the total angular momentum, has this form here, the Lorentz boost vector comes out in this form, the Hamiltonian of a free particle is this here. We can shift from this coordinate of the particle x hat to x bar, which is called the center of energy, and then you get this boost vector in this form. Yeah? This boost vector, which has this space part here, has in this space part, and this is called center of energy. So you already see here, we can introduce different positions for a spinning particle. And the reason is, a spinning particle is an extended object. If the energy is positive definite, the particle has to be is extended, and if you have an extended object, you have some degree of freedom in defining where is the center of the body. So I will go further later to show you more details. Okay, now, the Poincaré vector, the zero component is just this projection, you see spin with momentum, and the three is the space component of the Poincaré vector is this object, so it nicely decomposes in the canonical objects defined before. Now the general relation between Poincaré and spin tensor is given here, and this relation you have seen before. Okay? So you see that canonical formulation refines our understanding, gives more information, and you have to pay a price, you have to do more work to get it, it's clear. But this is what I wanted to start with. Now, if you have a canonical formulation, the holy grail of all physics in flat space-time or asymptotically flat space-time is the Poincaré algebra. Yeah. This is universally valid, and what does not fulfill the Poincaré algebra is no physics. Yeah. This is a necessary condition for its existence. Yeah. And these are all the commutation relations for the Poincaré algebra, the Hamiltonian, total angular momentum, total momentum. Here, this is a center of mass vector, which relates to the boost vector in this form here. So these are all the commutation with a Poisson bracket, written of the Poincaré algebra. Yeah, this is extremely important to Poincaré algebra because anything what happens in the world, yeah, if it is isolated, has to fulfill the Poincaré algebra. And with this Poincaré algebra, we control our coefficients of the Hamiltonian and of the boost vector, or the G-more. And this is a very crucial expression here. This is extremely crucial. This means that the total momentum is a time derivative of another object. It's a Poisson bracket with a G-vector. And if you use this, we get very many relations, and we can define or control very many coefficients in the Hamiltonian. Yeah? And also, sometimes even the boost vector is uniquely defined just by this condition here. This is trivial. These are all relatively trivial conditions, but this is a crucial one. Okay, so this is for the Poincaré algebra, which plays such a very crucial role in the Hamiltonian approach. Now, to the various centers of a spinning particle. So if you have a spinning particle here, it is, So it is rotating in this way, it is moving this way here. Now it's clear that the velocity here is higher than the velocity there, and this is higher than the velocity there because it's moving this way. This means the center of energy is shifted there. So this here is a boosted center at rest. If the particle, as object is at rest, and you boost it, then you get this here as a center of mass. If you look for the center of energy in the moving, where the object is moving, you get this point here. And if you look for the canonical center, you are just in between. Yeah, you have three centers. Yeah? So it's the energy center, the canonical center, which is the center of spin called, and the inertia center. The center of inertia is this here. And to these three centers, three different spin supplementary conditions relate. And these different supplementary are following. Now, this is the center of spin here, the first one. Okay, good. This is center of spin, and we have nice commutation between the components. Only for this center of spin, the x hat, the components do commute. These are the so-called Newton-Wigner coordinates. If you go to center of energy, in this definition, the components of x bar do not commute. We have a non-commutative algebra of the positions. So this is natural here. You do not need non-commutative algebra from fundamental some extension of algebra theory. You have already here non-commutativity. And the center of inertia, which I mentioned before, is defined this. The center of inertia is defined this supplementary condition. So if you impose that this is orthogonal, that this equation holds, you automatically get this center. If you impose this condition, that this is a unit vector to the time equal constant hypersurface, yeah? If you impose this condition, you get the center of energy, and if you impose this condition, you get this center of spin. So the different centers are uniquely related to different supplementary conditions, the spin momentum particles. So now the smallest radius of a spinning particle is S divided by MC. One can show, and because this is an extended object, you can define different places, the center, depending on your definition. If the energy is positive, definite. And this is very nice. It's just for fun. If you take S equal to h bar half, yeah, like for the electron, two times, you get the Compton wavelength. And what does the Compton wavelength mean? You cannot squeeze an electron state smaller than the Compton wavelength, otherwise you get positrons. Yeah. This is the most compact wave for an electron. You cannot squeeze it more. And also what is quite fun is the Kerr ring singularity in Berlin with Gordon is also S divided by MC. So it plays a very important role, this S divided by MC. It's a fundamental radius. We have not also Schwarzschild, only Schwarzschild radius, G divided by MC squared, two times. Yeah. But we have also such a fundamental length, which has nothing to do with gravity. It's just the spin divided by M and NC. Yeah. It's a fundamental thing. Mrs. Wheeler gravitation, you can find more details about this calculation. It took very many years before people clearly saw what's going on. Okay, this just for fun. Now I have a many particle system with interaction, arbitrary interaction, isolated system. The total momentum is always defined there, independent of the interaction. Total momentum, total angular momentum is always defined in this form if you have spin and momenta. Yeah. Then if you calculate h, the Hamiltonian, h squared minus p squared, and you call this m here, then this is definitely the rest mass energy. You can also write it in this form. And the canonical center is given in this nice form. So this is the canonical center. Yeah? M is coming, h is coming, g is coming. The boost vector here, the center of mass vector, this is h hat. And the h hat, the components commute with each other, p, the momentum commute with each other, this fulfills the canonical commutation relations, the standard one, x hat commutes with m, p commutes with m, and m commutes with h. This is very nice. This is full general. Whatever the dynamics is, if it's asymptotically isolated, you get these relations. You can so make use out of it and do calculations. So this is always valid then in gravity. If we like to have an n-body system in gravity and like to find the center of mass, or the one which has a canonical commutation relation with the momentum, I have just to do this, what you see here. It's just this here. Also in gravity, I show you very complicated objects in gravity, but this is fulfilled. An interaction was not specified. Conditions only asymptotically flat. Yeah? It's very powerful, very nice. Good. Okay, this is this here. Now for free particles with spin, it's clear. It's a sum of the single Hamiltonians, the G vector is this here, it's fully explicitly known, and then you can plug it in, it's trivial. So, okay, now let us look for higher order postnatal Hamiltonians. Now the spin is not counted 1 over C, it is just the C which comes from the Einstein equation. The C is C without counting, and here I will show you some results we have obtained, give you an impression of the expressions. Now, here you see the Hamiltonian up to 3.5 pn. This is not an autonomous. This is the first radiation damping level. This is the second radiation damping level. I put a T here because this is not an autonomous system. I will explain later the details of this object. Now, it is written as exponent function of time that you see it's not autonomous. Now, we can easily go to the center of mass frame because the momentum is defined. Total momentum has to be zero in center of mass frame. So we put center of mass equal to zero. Then we go to reduced variables, the parameter nu is defined here in this form, reduced mass divided by total mass, and it varies between 0 and 1 fourth. And if you introduce this nice reduced variables, then you see the Newtonian Hamiltonian has this simple form. This is then the post-Newtonian, 1 over C squared Hamiltonian, the nu is coming, the second post-Newtonian Hamiltonian can be calculated. And then there's coming the third. The nice thing is the following. For the first time, a transcendental number is coming as coefficient in the Hamiltonian. You cannot transform it away. This is really essential, or this is, so to say, genuine. This transcendental number is a coefficient of an Hamiltonian. So some mathematicians And at Bureau Survey have some ideas where it can come from general reasons, but it's funny that we saw that first, oh, maybe it's an error, but there's no error. It comes from the field degree of freedom, from the field degrees of freedom.
This could come from what?
Some complicated mathematical structure. I've not understood what the mathematician told. Okay. Concevich, you can ask Concevich in Bureau Survey, the field metals, you know. He had some complicated ideas why this is natural. When I was in Bureau, I discussed this in. Okay. Now, the leading order spin orbit coupling, you see, it's similar. It is all known in 75 by Dias. Dias calculated it, yeah. Also, the leading order spin coupling is by Dias. And the spin squared was done by Thorn and Hartle in 85. So this is, so to say, old stuff, old knowledge about our about this coupling here. Now, the next to leading order, this is so the spin orbit coupling next to leading order, you see. It goes much more complicated. We have also to add one with two exchange. This is a 2PN spin orbit coupling. And now as a spin one, spin two, it looks this complicated, you see. This clearly shows how you can do really nice calculations like an effective field theory. We can also do here similar calculations, and you get all things fully explicit. And you see fully canonical, you see. Canonical means we have the spin variable, which is canonical or the quasi-canonical. Some people do not call it canonical because commutator spin with spin is not zero. You know this, yeah? With the, again, spin, then some purists say, this is not canonical because you should have the standard canonical bracket relations, but you can it is canonical in my notion. Yeah? And you get, of course, then the momenta and the positions. The positions are also in. It's clear here, the positions. So it's a full canonical structure. Other variables are in. And the question is how to get it, is the point. And also the spin one squared you find here. These objects I will then compare with the effective field theory results, which got the similar results, but in a completely different representation. And I will show you how to come from this to the other, to this one, which I've shown you here. Yeah? Okay. Good. Now, the next leading order center of mass, this G, you see, it is here complicated. Here also, it's a four spin orbit. And we can nicely check it. We put it into Poincaré algebra, and all relations are nicely fulfilled, if it is correct. Yes. And this we have done in this form. So we calculate all conserved quantities. It is not conserved, but if you calculate the boost vector out of it, you get the conserved K. Yeah? Okay. Now, what is known? The Newtonian Hamilton, it's clear, is known. The 1PN, the 2PN, the 2.5 damping, 3PN, 3.5 damping is known. From the spin, these are known here. This is the damping one in spin orbit. This is a damping in spin, but recently calculated here. And these are the spin squared terms. And there are some other terms. You see momentum, spin cube, and so on, which are also known. And the Hamiltonian, the one post-Minkowskian approximation, is also known. These are the known, fully explicitly known Hamiltonians up to now. And now I have to explain you what is with this H of T. Yeah? So why I called it non-autonomous. These are non-autonomous. The red ones are non-autonomous. The black ones are autonomous Hamiltonians. You see the following. This Hamiltonian depends on the meta variables, P and Q, and on the independent field degrees of freedom, H, T, T, and pi, T, T, you will see later. And this depends also on meta variables after solving the field equations. And now you see we have two different kinds of variables, primed and unprimed here. Yeah? Primed and unprimed is a functional. If I integrate over the x, then I get a function of p, q, p prime, and q prime. So, and the point of follow, if I now identify p prime with q prime, I got nothing. Yeah? It is what yesterday was shown us. Yeah? But if I have to vary with respect to P and Q, and after variation, I have to identify P prime, the prime with the unprimed variables. And then I get the correct radiation reaction. This is the way it goes. Yeah? We have to have two sorts of variables. So to say, the P and Q, the meta variables, which are there from the outside the dynamical degrees of freedom, and the meta variables which generates the dynamical degrees of freedom here. And we have to give them two different notions, primed and unprimed. Okay? And this has to stay. Although with this here, we could also calculate these objects here. Yeah? And we differentiate here for getting degrees of motion. Afterwards, we identify prime with unprime. But if the system is conservative, we are allowed to identify this here on the Hamiltonian level. It's not quite correct, not on the Hamiltonian, but on the Roussian level. On the Roussian level, we are allowed to identify prime with unprime because the Roussian is a Lagrangian for the field. And the Lagrange has a nice property that the functional derivative of a Lagrangian is zero, the functional derivative. Okay? So the functional derivative of a Lagrangian is zero. So if I differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to these variables here, I've at first to differentiate with respect to, let us call it this now h and this h dot, htt dot. So let us put an r here and let us call this here htt dot, the Ruchian. Okay? It's the Ruchian, htt dot, and htt. Now, if I vary with respect to this and these variables, I have at first to vary with respect to htt and htt dot. But the functional derivative of a Lagrangian is zero because of the field equations. So this means it doesn't matter. I can differentiate here. It does not contribute. So this means if I identify this with the unprimed, I can differentiate whatever I like. I do not get an error because I know implicitly I have to differentiate with respect to this and then this, htt dot, and this is zero. So this means the Ruchian approach is the one which allows you to calculate autonomous Hamiltonians, eliminating the field degrees of freedom. This is the way we have done it from 2pn on, 3pn it was more explicit done, but this is the way we had to introduce Ruchian to get an Hamiltonian which only depends on the position and momenta without field degrees of freedom. You know, the Ruchian was introduced by Ruse when treating the top. When reading the top, he introduced his Ruchian. He became aware that it is an advantage to the variables which are conserved, which are cyclic, to put on the Lagrangian level, because then the derivative is zero. Yeah. And then he said, let us put the conserved, the variables where the conserved momentum, where the canonical momentum is conserved, put on the Lagrangian form, then one can easily or the better control or the better treat the conserved aspect of the problem. And the rest was Hamiltonian. Yeah? So this was the introduction by Ruse of the Ruchian. Yeah, this was famous. Then Landau-Lifschitz volume 1, you can find some, and not historical insight, they never quote, nearly never quote, but you find the technical details of the Ruchian, yeah? For example, but there are many other books. Okay, that's the reason why, and that's the reason why I call it explicit function of time, because this here, so to say, they do not belong to P and Q. With respect to P and U, this is something like explicit function of time, yeah? Explicit function of time, and we vary only with respect to these two. Okay, this is for this story. Now, spin and gravity. I told you that we have to introduce tetrads or vier binds, and it is very easy. Yeah? The tetrads are the square root of the metric, some square root of the metric. If you have local rotations, Lorentz rotations, you get this here, this structure here. You have to introduce a linear connection because the covariance, the derivatives, the partial derivatives, have to transform homogeneously under local Lorentz transformations. That's the reason why if you introduce these Ricci rotation coefficients, the G depends on the property of the phi. It's defined by the lead derivative of the phi. You introduce a G, and then you get the covariant derivative, covariant respect to these local rotations. Okay? And the local rotations themselves transform inhomogeneously. Inhomogeneous transformation, which is typical for connection. Yeah? Connection always transforms inhomogeneously. This is the inhomogeneous part. This is the homogeneous part. And that's all. Now you calculate the curvature, yeah? The covariant derivative, the commutator. You get the curvature in this form. And this is given by the Ricci rotations coefficients this way. And then you are finished. That's all. With one transparency, it's enough for introducing tetrads in Einstein theory. Because the Einstein tensor, the Hilbert-Einstein tensor, has now this form. You take the RAB, mu nu, you contract with a tetrad, you put the determinant of the tetrad, and this is just the Ricci's curvature scalar written with tetrads. That's it. So simple it is. Here, a total divergence you should always add, because you are always free to subtract or add total divergences. And in the ADM formalism, you subtract several of them. Also, you know, the famous one is the one by Gibbons and Hawking, the surface term, which is a total divergence, which is often used if you have, so to say, some surface problem or the surface integral properties to solve. So, okay. Now, the vacuum Einstein equation is the gate. You vary with respect to the tetrad. You get then this, the Einstein tensor here. If you vary with respect to omega, you put it to zero. You get this relation between the E and the omega, and there's no torsion. If you have this relation, there's no torsion included. One can show, as long as you are linear in spin, torsion does not come into play. Only quadratic in spin, you have the freedom to add torsion or no torsion. If you have torsion, it couples to quadratic in spin. If you're only linear in spin, torsion does not play any role. But here, I insist, of course, that we are in Einstein theory. Torsion has to be eliminated, does not contribute. But of course, on the other side, I'm linear in spin in this calculation. So it is quite a straightforward thing. Okay, this is what we need. We need the Hilbert-Einstein action in this form to be able to connect with rotating bodies. Otherwise, we are not able to do it. Okay. Now, the Lagrangian for spinning object. You see, this is extremely nice. You have here the four velocities, the four momentum. Without spin, this is not there, this is not there, this is just the kinetic part. If you now couple to gravity, you get this addition to the momentum. It's a minimal coupling, and in the Dirac theory, you would add to the partial derivative this object here. Okay? And this is a spin part here. Now, this is not a total derivative, this is this here. This object, okay, this is this here. This is internal matrix. Also, so this matrix lambda, or let us see. We have now an holonomic coordinate system of the world. Holonomic coordinate system, the indices are the Greek indices here. Then we have a tetrad, and each point we have a tetrad field. The indices are the A's and the B. We belong to the tetrad, to the Lorentz tetrad. Okay, so, and then we have this capital index here. This is the rotation of the body with respect to these tetrads. So this means we have a body fixed tetrad, we have the Lorentz tetrad, yeah, and we have the holonomic coordinates of space-time. And you see, it's very funny. If you couple the Dirac field to the gravitational field, you do not find this term here. This term is not there. You just take the Dirac equation, you plug in here the minimal coupling period. Now, why do we need here this term and Dirac field doesn't need it? You see, this index here, this index C, which we have here, is represented Dirac field by the spinor. So the spinor represents just this vector index for real object. We have to use the tetrad rotating with the body, which is fixed with the body. Yeah? Yeah. And this means Dirac field, you do not need this here, because the C is in the spinor, implicitly involved. But you can make a spinor transformation which induces a Lorentz transformation, for example. It's clear. And here, if you rotate the body, you make a Lorentz transformation to the Lorentz frame. Yeah? It's clear. So this is one point. And and this means if we make now a Vierbein rotation, then you see because of this structure, we get an addition from here. And this addition just cancels from here. Yeah? And this inhomogeneous transformation of the omega you have seen before, inhomogeneous transformation of the omega just cancels with the transformation from here, from this term there. So this means this Lagrangian you see here is manifest invariant against coordinate transformation, also space-time coordinate transformation, and Lorentz Vierbein rotations. Yes, it's a manifest invariant object. So now this is a redundant object, has too many degrees of freedom. We have now to fix too many degrees of freedom to have a unique evolution. What we have to do is we have to imply these are Lagrangian multiplier lambda 1, lambda 2, and lambda 3. We have the Machel condition. It's one supplementary condition. Then the spin orthogonal to P, the four momentum. And these rotation matrices are orthogonal to the momentum. It's clear because they are in the rest frame of the momentum. So these are the conditions, supplementary condition we have to use to get a consistent, well-defined dynamics. The complete action is given here. I call it W from the German Wirkung. S is for spin, and I call it Wirkung. Schwinger is also using W, but he knows it comes from the German Wirkung, it's action. Okay, this I already using, so it's not by chance. Okay, now if you vary this action, you will find this spin equation, the Kovan derivative is zero, this center of mass motion coupled to the Riemann tensor. This, you see, the lambda 3 is 1 over the rest mass, and this Lagrange multiplier, and the corresponding stress energy tensor is given in this form here. Okay? This is a point particle aspect, this is a spin aspect. It's a four-dimensional Kovan derivative. So this is what you get by varying here. And now we would like to make a canonical representation of this action. This is now our aim, to reformulate this here and this together in a canonical form. And this needs some work, and this is now what I would like to tell you. Good. Now, also, it is, so to say, canonical for all, for the matter and for the gravitational field. Okay? So now I first introduce here the Lebesgue shift function. Good. This is slicing, well known. This is the decomposition of the line element, Lebesgue, and this is shift function here, okay? Which is sometimes called the ADM decomposition. But it was known earlier, also in the middle of the 50s, Chokre-Bihar has introduced this. But Charlie Mason, I was told, has invented it independently. So you can call it as you like, ADM, for example. I should ask Deso, because he's very precise about those things. I've forgotten to ask him. what about this talk. Okay, anyway, these are the variables. The variables I am discussing is lapse function, shift function, and the three metric. Get the three metric inside here. The lapse function is this here, shift function is this, this is shift vector, okay? and this is extrinsic curvature. Okay? It's the second fundamental form. Okay. Now, the solution of the matter constraints. Now, with the Lagrangian multiplier, we solve the matter constraints and we get these relations. You see, this is a zero component of the moment, four momentum, which relates into the three momentum. Okay? It's clear. Yeah? This is just so the Machel condition here. Okay? This is a condition of the spin, that the spin is orthogonal to the four vector, is this condition here. And the other condition is that lambda is operating in the rest frame of the particle with momentum p. Okay? These are these Lagrangian constraints we get. And this is the simple thing. As a solution of the matter constraints is this here. Now we have to fix our tetrad. The tetrad E we have to fix. And I use a time gauge for the tetrads. The name was introduced by Schwinger, but it was found before by Dirac. Dirac didn't call it Dirac, the time gauge, but Schwinger called it time gauge, so it has a name, my username, so it's according to Schwinger. This means that the zero component or the zero tetrad is along the unit vector of the time-like, the space-like hypersurface t equal to constant. Okay? This is unit vector t equal to constant, and this is so the condition. If you use this, it's very nice. Then the three metric, you see, is just composed out of the these are the other three tetrads, triads. There's a triad, okay? And these are the space components. So it's very nice. That it nicely splits in this form. Now if I have the action of my matter system, then you can write part of it in this form here, the lapse shift function, and the H matter, it has this form here for our spinning particle, and the H matter, the supermomentum, has this form here. Yeah? And you see it's quite bad because extrinsic curvature is in here. Extrinsic curvature does not appear there because if there's extrinsic curvature there, this means our stress energy tensor depends not on the metric but also on the rotation coefficients, which is not nice, yeah? Because then you get, if you vary respect to the rotation coefficients, you get additional excitations, you get torsion and so on. Yeah. But we will see we can eliminate it. We can eliminate the extrinsic curvature and we will get rid of it later. Okay, this is the part of our original Lagrangian density, yeah, here, which is given there. And now as a transformation to canonical matter variables. Of course, you should believe me that the original was set. We go to set hat in this form. If we do this, if we do with S, this transformation to S hat, and if we go with lambda to lambda hat in this form, then we find that this is a canonical position, this is a canonical spin, and this is a canonical rotation coefficient for the spinning body. This we can do. And the canonical momentum, this is quite complicated. So this is the original one, and all this is to absorb in the new capital PI, which is now the canonical momentum of the system. It's quite a complicated thing, but it works. It's very nice, it works. Yeah. This redefinition, right? This redefinition of the A hat was defined in this form here. You can resolve it. The A hat is just a short notation for what is given here. And now you see the original spin, the spin squared was a constant, 2s squared. Okay? This was original spin squared. And this is now given by the three-dimensional components of s hat. Okay? So s hat three-dimensional parts, okay, has the same information as given in here. It is a conserved length, but the three-dimensional length, not the four-dimensional length. Okay? Now this here fulfill this nice relation, and of course the theta hat is then given in this form. So these are the canonical variables for the matter system with spin. Now, we are adding now the Lagrangian of gravity. Now you see, for the matter, this is left. This is the kinetic part of the center of mass motion. This is the spin part here, and this is in between left. And this part, which was left from the matter part, we add now to the Lagrangian of the gravitational field. Yeah? The gravitational field action, which is in the informus, it is this pi ij with the tri binds here. Yeah? And this is a constraint bind. This is a famous surface term from ADM, the ADM surface term. And we have to add this here, we have to add this matter part to the canonical momentum of the field. And so this is a field gets contaminated with matter variables. You see the spin is inside here. And this contamination is needed for finding a canonical formulation. This divergence here, the vector is given in this form, and this is a famous, ADM surface integral for the total energy. It gets finally the ADM Hamiltonian. Now for the field. The field, if I decompose the field, I get the same structure, Lebesgue shift. Yeah? And the field part, this is this here, and the momentum, this is an energy supermoment, this is super Hamiltonian, this is super momentum density is given here. So, and what we have then finally, this comes from this decomposition of the gravitational W. Okay? This is related to Lebesgue shift, this is a surface term. And this here, this is what you have seen before. Okay? This is just this here. This here, okay? This is this, and you have to add this from the matter. You have to add this. Yeah, and now we have to, And now we have to go back from our tetrahedral triads, we have to go back to the metric, because we would like to have a theory where only the metric is involved, and no triads or tetrads are involved. Yeah. And one can show in general that this object here can be written in this form, where this is symmetric, it's anisymmetric in property. And one can then solve it, so to say, forgetting the B's as function of the G's, of the metric, in the following form. We say that the tetrad, these are the tetrad components here. Yeah? What we do is, we call this here is just the square root of this. This is a positive definite symmetric matrix, the G, the GKL. And we take the square root of this matrix. This is a little bit symbolically writing. And the square root of this here, we identify with the length of this triads. Okay? And if we do this, then we can uniquely solve this here, and the B's do only depend on the metric, which we can iteratively calculate. And then we have here the canonical momentum is the original field momentum plus this term here, plus a part coming from the B. So this is now the canonical momentum for this. The recent calculation for the spin orbit and spin radiation reaction just needed this. Without this, we would have got a wrong result. So this is already tested. That this is correct and has to be done was already tested and is, so to say, existing. Now we have to introduce space-time conditions. These are additional conditions. So this means the three metric, we impose this condition here. And for the canonical momentum, we impose this, the trace, the non-covariant trace has to be zero. And this here results in this decomposition. So if this is fulfilled, then we can solve it in this form. It's an isotropic part and a transfer stressless part. This is TT transfer stressless. The canonical momentum, we can decompose in a longitudinal part and also in a transfer stressless part. Yeah. And these two are then the canonical conjugate independent degrees of freedom of the gravitational field. Yeah. This canonical longitudinal part, we decompose in a vector. You see the vector V involved here. And because of the trace, there's no scalar involved. The trace is zero, there's no only a vector, and this is a trace-free tensor, which is given here. And these are then the independent degrees of freedom of the gravitational field. It is this here, and the canonical conjugate. So, and we get the constraint equations. This and field plus matter has to be zero. This is a Hamiltonian constraint, and this is a momentum constraint, okay, which gives us this result. Okay. Now finally is a total action in canonical form. You see here this is a gravitational field part. This is from the particle, center of mass motion, the spin rotation here, and this is now the total energy, which is nothing else than the ADM Hamiltonian, if represented in the correct variables, and this variable is ADM Hamiltonian, and it's nothing else than the Laplacian, the three-dimensional integral of the Laplacian of psi. There's a psi. Was this metric function here. This metric function, you have to calculate this as functional of the other functions, and then you get this here as the ADM energy. And the variables you see here are canonical variables, all the other commutators vanish. Yeah? So you see here a nice canonical relation. This is the spin, standard spin canonical relation, and for the field variables, you get these relations here. Okay. So this is the canonical form. Now the comparison is the effective field theory method. Now the signature is -2. People work usually with -2 signatures, and I will do the same. Now this is a Lagrangian, next leading order spin orbit derived by Levy. And you see here this components of the spin, the zero I component,
should not be there if there is a canonical formulation. So this means we have to get rid of this degrees of freedom to come to a canonical formulation. So only if we get rid of from this and this and this and this, then we find a canonical formulation. Here, additionally, we have to integrate the time we have to put from here to there and to eliminate by equations of motion, which is allowed. It's a well-known technique one can apply. Okay? So finally, we have to eliminate these components of the spin tensor of particle 1 and, of course, of particle 2 also. And here, this is a next to leading order spin orbit by Porter-Rothstein. It has a completely different form. You see, it's completely different. Different variables, different way of integrating. You get a different representation, you see. Next to leading order spin. Oh, so it's only an R there. Okay, good, good. I did too much. Good, it's only an R there. Okay, sorry for this. Okay, we'll be corrected.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, you see, it looks.
No, that's actually
Porter-Ross. Yes, indeed. Okay. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I should have given. Yes, it is. I should have given the history. Sorry, indeed.
It's not important.
Yes, indeed. So, a double R. Get a double R. Andreas.
No.
Okay. Good. Next time. Good. Okay. Good. Yeah. Okay. Yes, our thesis. Okay, spin.
That one's good.
This is good. Fine. Okay. Then you see also again there are these components here of the spin tensor, which in a canonical formulation are not there. And the question is how to eliminate them in a consistent way to come to a Hamiltonian formulation. Yeah, to this here. And you will see it's not trivial to do this. Yeah. Okay. You see this object has to be eliminated here. Okay. And now the spin squared. It is this here, it's a spin squared. You also see here these objects over there, and the same again. Yeah? So, the primary result is this, and now you have to work on it to show equivalence between the two formalisms. And you can imagine that the next leading order is so complicated that it takes still time to compare the two formalisms. Okay, now what to do? Now, in this effective field theory approach, this condition is included already. So the Marshall condition is there, there's no discussion. Even we can choose such a representation by canonical transformation that this is the same, also identical with the canonical spin, this one can do. Not a complicated transformation from one momentum to another one, momentum can stay fixed, we have only to find the new position coordinates and the new spin variables to find a canonical formulation. Now, the brackets, the possible brackets fulfilled by, you see, the AB goes from 0 to 3. Yeah, these are really also, their 0, I is included here. Yeah, these are the possible brackets valid in this approach. Yeah, this is, so to say, a very general phase space given here. And the remaining supplementary, this is one supplementary condition. The other supplementary condition is this, we can, instead of P, we can use U. It doesn't matter. It is this here, and we have this condition, or this is equivalent here, that this component is parallel to U0. So these are the additional conditions here. And what we have to do is the following. We have now to write this as constraints. So to say, I will give you. So these are now our constraints. These are 3 for each particle 2. For each particle 3, so these are 6 and 6 are 12. These are 12 conditions, and I will show you. Now, these supplementary conditions, we calculate the Poisson brackets from the supplementary conditions and calculate from this with the standard brackets, the Dirac bracket. It's a Dirac bracket here. Then this goes in here, the inverse. You have to calculate the inverse. Then the equation of motion with Dirac brackets looks this nice with some effective Hamiltonian. We can derive from this Lagrangian. It's possible. But we would like to have now variables with hat, which fulfill with Dirac bracket just this commutation relations here. And these variables are then the canonical variables we are looking for. Okay? We have to find these variables which are fulfill this relation here. Now, what we have to do is the following. This is our metric, perturbation from flat space here. Now we have to look how our 4 vector and components decompose in the metric. And the metric, of course, we have also the tetrads here, as a tetrad included. We have to do it this way. Okay, we can reduce it to the metric coefficient, to the mu, okay, to h mu nu. We can do it this way. So I will shorten a little bit. And then we find that this is, so to say, one kind of supplementary condition. Zero is equal to this. And you see here, the S not I is included here, and that's momentum introduced. Okay? These are, so to say, these are three conditions for each particle. There are six conditions. And the other six are this here with a lambda. Again, three for two particles are six. These are so these conditions. And now we can then calculate the brackets, the Dirac bracket. We insist that we find the canonical variable in this form. And then we get that the set hat is related to the set in this quite complicated form here. And the same complicated structure we have here is the canonical spin. This non-canonical spin is this here. And if we plug it in and transform and so on, then we find agreement with what we have achieved in the Hamiltonian approach. So you see, it's not straightforward. Formally, conceptually, it is straightforward, but it needs a lot of calculations and some guesswork, some ansatz with unknown coefficients, and then check and so on and to find the result. Okay, so so all agrees, all is correct, apart from my misprint and who is who in this. Yeah. Okay, now about Delta function at black holes. Yeah. Okay, this is full agreement, so we can, so, okay. Now, again, back to the definition. So the three metric is, of course, in this form, the independent degree of freedom, and we have the canonical momentum. Now it's no spin. We have no spin. We have just two black holes later. Now we have this decomposition. It's just a reminder you what are the independent degrees of freedom. Now the Hamiltonian constraint written in EDM formalism is this here. It is just this equation, but written in EDM formalism, it looks this way. This is a momentum constraint equation. It's just this equation written in EDM formalism. Now for two black holes at rest, we have no momentum. Sorry, we have no momentum. Then this is zero. This is zero here. This is zero. So we get a very simple equation, which we will solve, and I will show what the outcome is. Now let us go to one black hole, isolated black hole. This is a metric of an isolated black hole in isotropic coordinates, and we know that this is inversion symmetric. If you make an inversion transformation, del R goes to minus, to 1 over R, 1 over capital R, then this metric goes over into this metric here. Okay? This is this famous structure. Maybe you remember here, okay? This famous structure of the throat. Okay, this throat here. Yeah, here is just the image here, yeah, the image just here. So this means this here is R goes to zero, here goes R to infinity, okay. Here over goes R to zero, and here goes R to infinity. This just this inflection symmetry of the Einstein-Rosen bridge, yeah, which you see here. So, okay, now let us go to two black holes. For two black holes, initially at rest, but you have to make the following. There are two black holes moving apart each other. At the moment, they start coming back. At the moment they are at rest. This is the solution. Yeah? It's the initial value solution of two black holes just at rest, wanting to fall now again back to each other. Yeah? And this is maximal slicing. And this is an exact solution of Einstein initial value equations. Yeah? It's an exact solution. And you see the following. If you go to the asymptotic regime here, you make the integral of the surface, you get this, a total ADM energy is just alpha 1 plus alpha 2. So, get the psi. The psi is this with here, psi to the fourth power, it is just here. Now you make an inversion map. We have now two black holes. Okay, we have now two. The other black hole is now here. So, okay. This is the other black hole, but here is a different end. It's a different end here. Okay? It's a different end. And now what we do is, we make now a reflection here. We reflect down here. We make this transformation. It's a position of the particle 1, this reflection. And then we get this original metric here. And then the reflected one is this. And what we do is then we make the surface integral here around here. We make the surface integral here. And this is nothing else than the rest mass of the body of the first black hole. Okay? And this is related to alpha 1 and alpha 2 in this form. Yeah? What we do is we make this surface integral, this integral here, this surface. Yeah? We get this here, we get this, and we make this surface integral here, and we get just the m1. And there's a relation between m1 and alpha, the coefficients we have seen before. Now, this is a pure vacuum calculation. Now, singularity is nothing around, all is vacuum. And now, we would like to do this with ADM formalism. we put HTT, pi dt, and p equal to 0. This is the only equation left. It's the only equation left here. We make this ansatz 5 with alpha 1, alpha 2. We plug it in. We have to use now dimensional regularization to get a unique result. Okay? And what we find is that the alphas, as a function of the m's, come this out. And the Berlin with Hamiltonian is then, this is also the rest mass, and this interaction energy between the two black holes is an exact solution of Einstein, okay? Of Einstein initial value equations. And this relation, what you see here, alpha is function of the m's, also alpha 1 and alpha 2, depending on the masses, okay? Is just an inversion of this formula here. Okay? This formula is m1, you have the same with m2, you get the same with the alphas and so on. And if you solve this, you get just this here. And this we also get using delta function. So delta function approach is completely equivalent to the Prelinquist approach, fully in vacuum calculation. And now, why is this d-dimensional calculation convincing, or why it works? You see, the d-dimensional metric is this is generalizing to d dimensions. Yeah. Then the phi function has now this structure with alpha 1, alpha 2 here. And the psi relates to the phi, which is given here in this form. And now my last transference is this here. This is, of course, the inverse Laplacian applied to delta function d dimensions. Our psi function, the psi function is this here. And now if you look to this object here, and this what you see here is nothing else than this, it is just this here. Get just this, yeah? Just this. Just this here. What you see here, you see the delta function at the point 1, okay, this is the Laplacian of phi, you give alpha 1, delta 1, and then you get this result from the left side. And it's clear if r1 is 0, either this here gives only something if r1 is equal to 0, though this is infinite, this is gives r1 2, this is nice, r1 2 we like, but this is infinite. But if we go to dimension between 1 and 2, between 1 and 2, then this is 0. Between if d is between 1 and 2, this is 0. So we go between 1 and 2, then this term drops out very nicely. Yeah? And what remains, then it's clear that this is we get then, okay, uniquely. And then afterwards, we go with d to 3. By analytic continuation, we go to 3. And then we get this result I've shown you before, okay, here of the coefficients and symmetric and so on. Yeah. Now the question is, the final question is, where is the support of our delta functions? Yeah? Where is the support of the delta functions? This is my last concern. You see, the question is here. This delta function has a support. Where is this located, this support? Now, if I write down this, for example, maybe I put it on I have to put it here on this side. Yes, there are many people. Yes, indeed. Now we have here, this is, okay, now this is Penrose diagram of a Schwarzschild black hole. Okay? The singularity is here of a black hole. This is really the singularity where the curvature is infinite. So, and this means here in this end, the support of the delta function is in real space. But the world is flat here. Okay? So because you see, the r equal to 0, if we go r with r equal to 0, okay, then we go from here. Here is the Schwarzschild radius in isotropic coordinates is m divided by 2r. M divided by 2 is just this point here. If we go to 0, we come here. So this means the support of our delta function is in physical space on this edge here, not here where the singularity is, or there for a white hole. It is over there. But it is not in real space. It is in conformally related space because if you look back here, here you can see. Let us look here. Yeah. This is a conformal transformation of the metric. Okay? And the delta function is located in this fictitious metric here. Okay? This conformal transformation goes to the fictitious flat metric here. In this fictitious flat metric, my delta function has support. There is a point mass sitting, and this point mass generates a field, and this field is a metric field in another space. And this metric field has a surface, has a horizon. This means I generate with a delta function, with a point-like delta, with delta function, with point-like support, I generate an extended object. Like in electrodynamics, okay, if I have a charged sphere, okay, as a field outside, and I can represent the charge on the sphere as a point inside in the center, is a fictitious charge, image charge, and this image charge, the delta function, generates a field outside,
and the charge definitely is distributed over the sphere and not inside the sphere. And what in electrodynamics is a sphere, the mechanical sphere, is in gravity topology. Yeah? At the gravity topology, in electrodynamics, the mechanical sphere. What in electrodynamics is a charge in the field is in gravity symmetric in the energy, which is sitting around there. Yeah. And though there is a strong analogy between the both schemes, and this is the way, so to say, I understand the calculations. By the way, we do not get these nasty poles in our calculation, in d-dimensional regularization, like Luc got. Luc got poles, he had to make a transformation for transforming away the poles. We do not get poles. Why do we do not get poles? I'm pretty sure our fictitious mass is sitting optimal. We have an optimal position, though it gives, so to say, well-balanced result. And in your case, with harmonic coordinates, your r equal, this is my formally, my r equal to 0 is here. But his r equal to 0 is here. Well, r equal to 0 is in Schwarzschild coordinate equal to m. So his r equal to 0 is located here. And my r equal to 0 is located there. Has nothing to do with any real singularity. We are sitting somewhere fictitious. It's only a tool for representing some metric we are interested to calculate. And that we do the correct things is just, of course, you see the differential equations combine different terms with each other, and they make it correct. And so finally, the outcome is the same if you do this calculation or that calculation. Yeah? So this is, so to say, how I understand. Sometimes I've written up it, but some people, I do not know what other people think about this. I find it nice. That's the reason why I was talking about. Okay, it was my last transparency. Thank you. Yeah. Just in time. Again. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So maybe it's related to this conformal magnetic topology you were talking about. But so if I understand correctly from that Penrose diagram, we live in the right diagram.
We live indeed.
And so the point where your delta function is located is infinitely far away for us.
Yes.
In any physical sense. Okay?
Yeah.
So how can it create a finite field where we are?
How can it create a finite field? If you create a function of, you see the infinity from this particle to us, okay, because it's far away, it's this infinite distance, it's a geometrical infinite distance, it is just a distance from here, also we are living here. So to say, we are living here, okay, at this point here, we are living there, which means we are living there, okay? So if I go to here, then I go just to here. Yeah? If I'm my finger here, then I'm here. Okay?
Yes.
So if I go this way, I go this way here.
Yeah? Yeah.
So this is, so to say, in real geometrical space. So.
Yeah, exactly. But so when you actually go from the center of your diagram all the way to the left corner, you have to go an infinite distance. That space is asymptotically flat. So
yes, but it's a metric. It's a metric. It has infinite. It's not infinite in the coordinates. So the r goes from the finite value to zero. The r goes from m half here to zero. That's all. So this is a finite distance for the coordinate, which is infinite in geometry. This is the difference of the measure. You see, we have a coordinate measure, which is finite. We have a metric measure, which is infinite.
Yeah, but. Maybe I'm not correctly your point, but let's pray for a second about the left part of the diagram.
Yeah.
Suppose I put a delta-like source at spatial infinity in our part of the diagram, in the right corner there.
Yeah.
So do you agree that at any finite values of the coordinates, the influence of that source is going to be zero?
Of course, it is instantaneous, it's clear. It is space-like connection, it is not a dynamical connection, it's space-like.
No, but even forgetting about that, I'm just saying it's infinitely far away, so in any physical sense, so whatever one over r creates, when it gets all the way to finite distances from the center, let's say, that's zero.
Okay, so maybe we can discuss it by lunch. It's a little bit more subtle, yes, indeed, yeah?
Okay.
There are no questions and let us start.